Welcome, everyone, to episode 119 of the NBA podcast. I'm Brian Toporek, and today we're going to talk about how the NBA could help reform youth basketball, the suddenly surging Lakers, and we're going to talk about some mental health stories from Kevin Love and DeMar DeRozan that have come out as of late. Before we get underway, wanted to remind you that you can follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. In our bio, you can find our Twitter handle, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes, so please subscribe, download, leave some five-star reviews. We'd love any feedback. And we're being hosted this year on FanRag Sports, so check them out on Twitter at FanRag Sports and for their NBA content at FRS Hoops with a Z. Joining me today, as always, is my very stable genius of a co-host, Morten Jensen. How's it going, Mort?
It's going well, Brian, because you know who's not a stable genius?
Sam Nunberg.
I was actually thinking more along the lines of Isaiah Thomas, like the good old version of Isaiah Thomas,
yeah.
The Detroit Pistons version, because, our friend who has not been on the podcast, and we need to change that, Duncan Smith, who's from The Athletic, a terrific Pistons writer, more or less called out Thomas for his cap management on Twitter, and Thomas responded. And I was a valued member of the NBA and NBA's Player Association, yada, yada, yada. And then everyone just shut him down because, you know, his cap situation with the Knicks back in the day was just atrocious.
Right.
So shout out to Duncan Smith for owning a Hall of Famer. I kind of like that one.
Well, shout out to Duncan for having the restraint not to fire back. He's smart enough to know that's not going to go anywhere. And he just let everyone else to do that for him as he kind of just sat back and laughed. But yeah, that spiced up Monday night in case The Bachelor wasn't spicy enough for you.
I woke up to it, so I want to wake up to that every morning. Just some guy just roasting Isaiah Thomas for his cap management skills.
Oh, I thought
that would be wonderful.
I thought you meant an ex-NBA player roasting a basketball blogger on Twitter.
No, that's difficult. I think the blockers have a leg up when it comes to Twitter wars with players because they were too busy playing. They were not in on all the whole internet thing. And then, it's kind of like the whole Parkland kids, teenagers thing where every politician who goes after them, they just get owned completely by these kids who grew up on the internet.
NBA players were too busy making millions of dollars and becoming famous.
That just hurts.
But we got the leg up because we're better on the internet than them. Booyah. All right.
Oh my God, we're so pathetic.
Well, on that note, Mort, let's talk about this big story from Brian Windhorst of ESPN that came out on Monday. So a couple episodes ago, we briefly mentioned the whole NCAA recruitment scandal.
Right.
And we said at the time, the story A, isn't going away. B, doesn't only affect the NCAA. Like, there are going to be NBA impacts as well. Lo and behold, Windhorst comes out with this story Monday, says the NBA is preparing to get involved again with elite high school basketball players. It's not currently clear which direction it will take. It's going to have to collectively bargain with the Players Association pretty much no matter what it does. So, Mort, let's just run through a couple different ideas of how the NBA might be able to help, dare I say, clean up this whole mess that the NCAA has created with its whole amateurism model.
I love that the NBA has to go clean up something, you know, clean up a mess that the NCAA made.
Right.
But okay.
I mean, the NBA, to be fair, kind of contributed to this mess with the one-and-done rule, which it created in 2005, which prevented high school players from declaring for the draft without going to college. Now they have to spend at least 1 year after graduating high school. They could either go to college, the G League, international, doesn't matter, but they have to spend 1 year out before they can declare. Yeah. So I guess, Mort, that's probably the most logical place to start. Adam Silver has discussed the one-and-done rule. Michelle Roberts has discussed it as well. Do you think the NBA should get rid of it?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I mean, if you are a high school kid, like DeAndre Ayton type, or, you know, I'm losing his name, right? Zion Williamson, who's going to Duke next year, who's mm-hmm. just a physical freak. If those guys feel ready athletically to compete in the NBA, then give them a shot. I mean, worst thing is they fall in the draft and they enter the league 1 year too soon, and the league kind of redshirts them, or you know, the team redshirts them and sends them to the D League and develops them a little bit slower. They'll still come around. Mm-hmm. I don't see a problem with it, honestly. I mean, look, I think back in the day, you know, with the whole high school influx, you know, Kwame, Tyson, Eddie Curry, all those guys, mm-hmm. that was just a weird time because the league was sort of in disarray. Michael Jordan had just retired. The league was lacking an identity. Ratings were down. It was probably the worst brand of basketball since the 70s. Everything was ISO, and everything was about stars and branding and hip-hop. And when I say hip-hop, like, players wanted to be hip-hop stars, likewise as NBA players. Like, the focus wasn't entirely on the court. Mm-hmm. Everything was, I need to emulate Jordan. I need to get my brand going, in whatever capacity that meant. So these high school players were just never really given a proper NBA education. Mm-hmm. Whereas today, we see these players, you know, these veterans who just live for basketball and nothing else. You know, they play a game and they go home, mm-hmm. which I really like. Teams have, over the last decade, preferred players who got their life in order and who are great quality people, not just quality basketball players. So a red flag is more severe now than it was 10 years ago. So you have these high caliber personalities now in the league who are, in my opinion, more ready to kind of take these high school kids who come into the league under their wing and go, you know what, young fellow, let me just show you the ropes here. Mm-hmm. So I think the NBA is just more prepared now mm-hmm. for having another influx of high school stars. And also, I think players are smarter. Even young kids now who are on the internet a whole lot more, you know, have access to so much more information. I think a lot of those kids, they're not going to go to the league prematurely. They're going to look at what's out there. They're going to look at teams. They're going to listen to college offers. They're going to look at overseas offers, and they're going to try to gauge their own game. Like, am I ready? I don't think this is a similar situation as back in the day when, oh, I'm a high school kid, that automatically means I'm attractive to NBA teams. I think those days are gone, and I think players know that. I think agents know it, and I think teams know it. So overall, I just think everyone is ready now.
Yeah, so, I mean, I definitely agree that for the top players, like a LeBron James, a Kevin Durant, you know, recent examples, a Ben Simmons, a Kyrie Irving, you don't gain that much from going to college. In terms of your basketball development, you would be better suited not having to pretend to go to class and pretend to do work, and you can just get with an NBA team, start learning the rigors of being a professional basketball player, get, you know, be able to devote your entire time to that, and your, you know, diet, exercise, sleep, all that good stuff, that be exposed to an NBA training staff. So for those guys, like, if it means getting those guys in the league earlier and not making them do this charade of being a college player for a year, I'm totally cool with that. I would push back a little, though, because I do think we would see examples where guys who aren't those top prospects would declare. And I guess the argument, you could argue that, well, that's their problem. Like, if they're not ready, an NBA team just isn't going to choose them. But then what happens to those guys? Like, I do worry about kind of the class above, like the top five recruits or the number one recruit in that class. Like, what if the number 15 guy has someone blowing smoke up his ass and is like, don't worry, dude, you're going to be a late first round pick. You're still going to get a guaranteed contract at millions of dollars. Just go. And then he goes to the combine. He goes through workouts. Teams realize he's not ready. He doesn't get drafted. Now he's not going to college. He can go to the G League, but I think the maximum salary there is like $26,000. He can go abroad, I guess, and then try next year. But I do worry that there would be a pipeline of kids who kind of get lost in that mix.
Well, I agree with you on that, but aren't we also at times seeing freshmen who leave college too soon?
Yeah.
Like, isn't that the same situation, basically?
Yeah, I mean, probably to... I would worry that it would happen to a greater degree if there were... Yeah. If it was just, you can go straight out of high school. I would think, you know, again, it's like... I just worry about the outside influences. Like, I don't think if you get rid of the one-and-done rule that there still aren't going to be agents and runners and shoe companies getting in on these kids throughout high school and telling them, like, you know, thinking about themselves more than the kids. Like, I'm a lot of my thinking here is coming from John Anthony Abrams' book. I think it was called Boys Among Men, and it was, you know, tracking the prep to pro transition. And, like, yeah, there were a lot of success stories back then, like Kobe and KG, LeBron, Dwight Howard. But then there were
Tracy McGrady.
Yeah, right. And but then there were a lot of guys who didn't transition very successfully.
Mm.
And it's those guys who I worry about. But that said, I mean, to your point, Mort, I think teams are better equipped now in terms of player development, in terms of paying attention to the needs of each player and realizing, like, you know, this kid, let's say we drafted an 18-year-old, he's probably not, unless he's LeBron James, he's probably not going to be ready to be fed to the Wolves for 35 minutes a game as a rookie. Like, let's bring him along slowly. We know this is a project. This is an investment. This is a long-term investment. Like, we have, if it's a first-round pick, we have this kid under team control for up to 9 years. Let's not F this up by overwhelming him too early. Let's run him off for 10, 15 minutes a game off the bench at first. Dip his toes in the water, get used to being an NBA player before we throw him overboard. Say, you know, you're playing 35 minutes a game and guarding James Harden on night one of your NBA career. I don't think there are that many teams that would do that kind of thing.
No, I agree. That's only for the absolute physical freaks out there who would have gone number one regardless, right?
Right.
Yeah, I agree. It's an interesting thought, you know, process, because obviously we have those Corleone young examples going back to back in the day. But I mean, when you look back at the amount of high school players who ended up becoming either stars or good starters, like, you also have a Rashard Lewis in there, for example. Like, that was a significant amount. And it, just going back to Rashard Lewis, like, the Sonics didn't rush him. And suddenly he started finding his rhythm in, like, year two or year three, and it just kind of worked from there. So to your point, I think that would be a very logical assumption that NBA teams would take that approach with players who are, like, maybe not majorly athletic freaks, but still NBA caliber players in their senior year in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I mean, look, a year younger also means another year of learning in the NBA. The first 4 years of that player's career, you know, instead of college, oh my God. I mean, the development curve would just be so much better, especially in this environment today.
Yeah. So the other thing that I worry about, at least from the NBA perspective, is obviously you have far fewer opportunities to scout these kids against elite competition. You know, they play AAU tournaments every summer, but outside of that, like, you can only schedule so many marquee games if you're at high school. And I'm looking back now a couple years to look at, like, all right, you know, what were the recruiting rankings coming out of 2013, for instance? And, like, most of the top guys, it was Wiggins, Randall, Aaron Gordon, Jabari Parker were the top four, which is, you know, Randall fell to seventh, Gordon. It was basically those four guys were all top 10 picks.
Yeah.
Number five was Andrew Harrison. Number six was Aaron Harrison. Number 14 was Joel Embiid. The next year, we're going to 2014 now. The next year, Jahlil Okafor was the number one overall recruit. Emmanuel Mudiay was number two. Stanley Johnson was third. Cliff Alexander was fourth. Karl Anthony Towns was fifth.
Mm.
So do you think there's a concern, at least from the NBA side, of, you know, where, like, this is going to add a lot more variability to the top of the draft because we just don't have the scouting opportunities that we have when these kids go to college.
Yeah, that's a good point. I don't think the NBA would look at those rankings. I think teams would look at the players individually and then make a decision based upon that. I think it was pretty obvious that Karl-Anthony Towns was always going to be better than Cliff Alexander. So, right. I mean, just get him in for a workout. The fact that the NBA... let me just reiterate here. The NBA right now NBA teams do not have access to high school game, or they're not allowed in high school gym. They're not allowed to scout high school, right? But obviously they do it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, otherwise Michael Porter won't get drafted,
right.
Theoretically.
Right. Right.
But that's obviously the. I always thought that was a weird inclusion in the whole thing. I think they should be allowed to scout in, you know, high school. Obviously, they do.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's kind of weird that the NBA is trying to limit NBA's team's availability in terms of when to scout a certain player. LeBron James' son right now, LeBron James Jr., who's mm-hmm. 13 years old,
mm.
He's all over YouTube, he's all over Instagram probably, stuff like that. NBA teams would have to be blind not to see something,
mm-hmm.
and they would have to be stupid if they saw something good not to look at it any further. So the league should just open up, you know, scouting, and then obviously there should be some rules, like you would have to be 18 to get drafted or something, or just out of high school at the latest, if mm-hmm. you're... you know, late 17, just about to turn 18, I guess that's fine. Both Jermaine O'Neal and Kobe Bryant were 17 when they were drafted, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
But just open up the scouting game at any age whatsoever. I don't see a problem with that.
So to that point, let's move past the one and done and talk about some other options the NBA is considering. Windhorst reported, as you alluded to, a plan is expected to include the NBA starting relationships with elite teenagers while they're in high school, providing skills to help them develop both on and off the court. It would ultimately open an alternate path to the NBA besides playing in college in a way 18-year-olds could earn a meaningful salary either from NBA teams or as part of an enhanced option in the developmental G League. So, again, there's nothing concrete at this point. Windhorst said Adam Silver, the NBA commissioner, could present a plan within the next few months, but there is a commission on college basketball that is going to present a report this spring. Silver is seemingly waiting to see what they have to say before coming up with anything on his end. But let's look at the G League first, Mort. So right now, mm-hmm. again, I believe the maximum salary... is around $26,000. Do you think there's a way aside from two-way contracts?
Right, right.
Do you think there's an avenue there for the NBA to expand this and say, you know, kind of create a separate, like, two-way contract for 18-year-olds, basically?
Yeah, I think so. Look, the NBA is financially in very good shape. They mm-hmm. it would have to be an investment for sure, but they could pump money into the G League if they wanted to. Mm-hmm. No problem there. So I think they should treat the G League a little bit differently than they do now with the low salaries. Mm-hmm. I would like to see it bumped up a little bit because they have every chance of making that secondary league attractive, not just for players, but for fans as well. Because when you look at that league, there is substantial talent right there. It's just because there aren't these marquee names in terms of Kevin Durant or whatever. But if you take the best G League team and you tour it in Europe, that would win like 80-85% of the games, mm-hmm. not more. I mean, so what I'm sitting there thinking that the G League is just a hidden gem in terms of what it can be. And if the NBA could find a way to create some rules that would allow these young kids to play on G League teams without having like an official or unofficial agreement, wink, wink, with the team that owns that G League team, that would be perfect. And I think that's where, you know, the concern comes in, because every team now, more or less, owns a G League team. And if a high school kid who's touted as possibly the number one guy a year from now, and he decides, I want to go to the G League a year before I want to get drafted, for example, like, let's just mm-hmm. say he wants to do that, and he's affiliated with the Lakers squad or whatever. Teams would be like, oh, do they have an inside track on this kid? Not right. that matters because the draft would prevent that. But then,
right.
you know, no, but like in free agency later on, oh, he's got ties with the Lakers. Could he consider taking the qualifying offer 4 years from now just so he can sign with the Lakers because he had that 1 year with their organization-ish? There are probably the fear of having people's toes being stepped on, which I get. But I do think it's possible. I think everyone wants the same thing. Everyone wants a good product. Everyone wants to see the G League grow and be financially stable in its own right. So, I mean, I would develop the hell out of it. But, okay, I'm from Europe, you know. I'm all in on the academies. I'm used to a different type of system. For me, when it comes to football and all that, it's all about youth academies, you know, young football squads, and seeing these kids climb in the ranks. So whenever the word development, player development is being floated around, I'm just like all in, right off the bat, because I want the best for young players always. I think that's going to improve the product. So whatever the NBA can figure out, and I mean, I would probably be behind it.
So I'm glad you mentioned the academies, because that was another thing Windhorst mentioned as a thing that the NBA explored. So again, as you mentioned, kind of similar to what European soccer and basketball clubs use. It would just be, he said they would house and train dozens of the country's elite high school basketball players. The NBA has a couple academies internationally, three in China, one in India, and one in Senegal, and a global academy with prospects across the planet at the Australia Institute of Sport. Recently opened another academy in Mexico City, according to Windhorst, but he reported that after discussions with teams and examining challenges and possible unintended consequences with establishing these operations in the U.S., the NBA has decided not to go down the academy path at this time. So,
yeah.
Mort, you are going to have more experience with the academy stuff than 99% of U.S. basketball fans, myself included. So can you just give us kind of a primer on how they work and what these possible unintended consequences might be?
Well, let's start with how they work, and I could use my own son as an example. Like, he's only six, but like right now he's affiliated with a football club. Like he's playing with on a youth squad, and let's just for the sake of the argument say that he becomes really, really good, and he sticks with that team. Like they have a first team, the one that competes, and then they have secondary academy squads for players who are under 18, under 17, under 16, under 15, and so on and so on and so on. And then usually whenever a kid, moves up in age, they go to a different squad. But if that kid is really, really good, and let's say he's 12, he can still be moved up to the under 16 squad, because maybe that's his line of, that's that quality he has. This 12-year-old might be as good as someone age 16. So he'll play there, and they'll kind of gauge, the whole club will be gauging, where do we put him? Like, is he going to climb further over the next couple of years? And just here, a while ago, the second largest football club in Denmark, Brøndby, they had a 16-year-old kid out there for the first team. Like in the top league, top football league in Denmark, 16 years old, playing in the midfield, and maybe they had some alternatives who were better, but they decided this kid was ready mentally and physically to compete at that level, and they gave him a chance. And so they're rewarding early payoffs. They're rewarding these kids who are just working their butts off and are very close to being similar to the adults in that vein. And That means that they don't really put a limit on where this guy can be. Whereas the NBA and the American ecosystem, it's always like, it's very set in these square boxes. You have to be 1 year removed from this. You have to go this. You have to go here. You have to do this and this and that. That's not how it works over here. Like, Ricky Rubio, I believe, got his debut for Juventus at the age of 14 professionally. it just allows players to get ahead a little bit earlier, and it makes them more available for the first team, so they can sort of see what they have in the pipeline, mm-hmm. and they can develop them at their own speed. And here's the great thing about it: like, if a kid is moved out to the first team and he struggles, then he's just moved back to the academy teams until he's ready. Like, there isn't this thing where, oh, he signed an NBA contract, which means that he's sort of locked into this thing. Yeah, sure, you can move him to the D League back and forth, but that's not really why and how the G League works. Mm-hmm. Whereas in football over here, or not just football, just in handball and everything, over here the system is way more fluid. Mm-hmm. It just creates some situations that can be tailored for the specific player and his specific needs. Mm-hmm. And I kind of appreciate that. And I want to see the NBA and the NCAA and the G League come together and find a solution that would make things more fluid for basketball players in the United States. Because right now it's just so locked. It's right. So locked. You have to take 1 year of college. After that, you sign an NBA contract if you get drafted. Now you're on this 4-year contract and you better improve. And if not, you're being sent down to the G League, which is just, it's a completely different beast, because the difference in G League and NBA is obviously tremendous. Mm-hmm. So it's not really a fair simulation of where that player will go. And there needs to be more flexibility in how you do it. You need to streamline these leagues, both college and G League and NBA, in a way where it's easier to integrate these players and also be able to adjust to these players' mentalities and inclinations and needs and whatever. And it's just a different beast. The ecosystem is just so vastly different. Mm-hmm. I want to see an academy. I would definitely want to see an NBA academy in the United States. But, I mean, then the question arises, if the NBA creates an academy with the best high school players in the nation, for example, mm-hmm. well, who do they play against? Like, what's right. the competition?
Right.
And that's where you kind of look at the AAU system and go, oh, well, that solves the issue. But AAU is a corrupt little model that's just... A lot of players, they go into the AAU circuit, and then when they come out of it and become, you know, all-stars and whatever, then they have the confidence to open their mouths and go, yeah, that wasn't really good, but I had to do it for my own, mm-hmm. you know, my own brand. I had to showcase myself. So if we can find an alternative to the AAU circuit where the NBA is actively involved, and maybe even the NBA and the NCAA together, I mean, I'm all up for that.
Yeah, so on the academy note, I mean, it's interesting, and I agree with your point that it'd be great to give these guys the opportunity if they're ready, because I look at a guy like Luka Doncic, who's going to be a top 3 pick almost unanimously in this year's draft class.
Oh, yeah.
He was a professional. He debuted with Real Madrid at the age of 16.
Yep.
You know, it I don't want to say that gives international players like an unfair leg up on U.S. players, but, you know, it's valuable scouting that, you know, NBA scouts can now look at 3 years of tape of Luka Doncic playing against professional players. And, you know, right. the people who say, oh, well, college is better, you know, the NCAA is better than any international league, that's not true at all. Like, Luka Doncic is playing as grown-ass men in the top-tier Spanish league. Like, that is valuable scouting information. So, yeah, it would be really... I don't know how the NBA does it. I think you brought up some very fair points about who do they play. And then, you know, on the NCAA side, I could see them saying, well, you know, who do we get? Like, who do we have left? If you're taking all the top basketball players, like...
Right.
What, you know, what's going to happen to all of our marquee programs? Like, is CBS and Turner Sports going to want to continue paying billions of dollars for the NCAA tournament every year when we're not getting guys who are, you know, the top NBA prospects? Like, that's part of the appeal, is watching a Kemba Walker or watching a Stephen Curry go on these ridiculous runs and then become a top 10, top 15 pick. If you don't have that, does that affect the NCAA's business model? Should the NBA care about that?
No. No, yeah. They shouldn't. Here's where I stand. The NCAA have had so many chances at correcting their product and also allowing players to earn money outside of the floor. And you know what? Whatever mess that they've created for themselves is self-made when it comes to the reputation that they have. I know you said earlier that the NPA, you know, added to their list of problems with the one-and-done rule. I agree with that to a certain extent. But there are always issues with the NCAA. So I think their brand is hurting on their own accord. And I don't think it's a coincidence that the NBA's brand is stronger than ever. I mean, it just seems that the reputation of each league are just so vastly different, because one seems very dictatorship-ish and the other is way more open and free-flowing. And that's why I think that those two leagues should come together and sort of find a product that's in the middle ground, where players can develop at their own speed and own pace. And that's another thing, you know, in terms of that, because we all have these ideas that a player who's, let's say, a physical beast in high school, we have this idea that he's going to follow his development curve, you know, 1, 2, 3. But it could be that that person, even though he's dominating in high school, stays at 1 for a year and doesn't take that one leap, but does that the following year.
Right.
But the system is just like, no, because your reputation is you're NBA ready, so you got to go. And we all know that players who stay in college for more than 1 year, they have a tendency to get torn down a little bit.
Yep.
So if a player, I think I actually have a pretty good example. Let's take Miles Bridges. Bridges was a guy who was supposed to be a lottery pick last year. He decided, you know what, I'm going to go back to Michigan State. And everyone was like, he's going to be the best player in college basketball next year, meaning this year. He hasn't been. He's been good. But he hasn't made that big, fantastic leap that everyone thought he would. And now he's slipping in the mock drafts. Whereas he's still improved. Like he's a clearly a better player now than he was last year. And the depth of this year's draft class is not even as significant as last year. So theoretically, he should at least stay in the same position. But he's slipping now in a more slim draft just because, he didn't live up to our expectations. Right. We have this mantra of 1, 2, 3, but he was stuck at 1.5. So, and then everything just falls to shit, which is just so weird to me. And that's where the flexibility of Europe would just help this dude.
Yeah.
Like, oh, your development is not going as we planned. Fine, we'll just take you back a slot to the team just below this one. And you'll regain some confidence. You'll see that you are the man. And then after you just get your mind straight in a couple months, back up to the first team again. Oh, look, you're succeeding. That level of flexibility would just be wonderful in American basketball.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think back to the last time Georgetown basketball was good with Jeff Green and Roy Hibbert back in the late 2000s. It was, they go to the Final Four. Jeff Green declares after 2007. He was the number 5 pick that year. Roy Hibbert comes back, falls down to number 17. If Hibbert declared that year, he would have been a top 10 pick. But as you said, he comes back, doesn't add that much to his game. He's still just the same guy, basically. He did hit 1 3-pointer, a very memorable 3-pointer that his senior season. But otherwise, just a great rim protector, good rebounder, good shot blocker. Not a super elite offensive option, which we saw pan out in the NBA. If Jeff Green comes back, I don't know if he's a top 10 pick that next year. It's a crappy system to incentivize these guys to leave, because if they come back, they're going to get torn apart. So I'm glad.
Yeah.
I think the bottom line from this whole thing is I'm very glad to hear the NBA is taking a serious look at this. I think it is long overdue. Yeah. I wouldn't, for anyone expecting a radical change by next year, I would say that's not going to happen. The fastest thing that's going to happen in this whole thing is the NCAA is going to have to adopt the Olympic model, where kids can start getting money for endorsements and signing autographs and all that stuff, because they're the ones with the major problem. In terms of this whole recruiting scandal, the NBA is just trying to step in and help, because they realize, you know, all these players are, all these elite players are going to come to us one day. So it is, it does affect us, right, even not, if not directly. So, you know, any right. final thoughts, Mort, on this whole thing?
Well, I just, yeah, I just want to bring up one last example because I think yeah. that's pretty significant. Joakim Noah would have been a Toronto Raptor if he had declared the year before he did. Like, remember, he, Al Horford, and Corey Brewer returned to Florida, back. And they won. Yeah, and they won the championship again. So he would have gone ahead of Andrea Bargnani in the 2006 NBA draft.
Yeah,
he would have gone number one. Instead, he went to the Chicago next year at number nine.
Yep.
He fell from one to number nine because he stayed in college a year more, and clearly that year helped him. I know his stats weren't as good, but when you win the championship again and your defense, like, his defense was drastically improved from his sophomore to junior year.
Mm-hmm.
No one seemed to recognize that. That was like, oh, well, he decided to stick around, so let's punish him for doing so.
Right.
And let's let him slip. Like, there's no way he was like supposed to go ninth. Ninth? From number one the year before? That's ridiculous.
He staved off Greg Oden in that championship game, too.
He did. Yeah. He did. And I understand that the 2007 draft was deeper, obviously.
Yeah, right.
But not to the extent that he had to go ninth.
Right. Did Corey Brewer go before him?
Yeah, he went to seven.
Oh boy.
Yeah, I mean, it was, but that draft was weird though.
Yeah.
I mean, you had Yi Yang going sixth.
Oh, right? Yeah. Oh god. And
Brandon Wright was going eighth. So yeah. It was it was weird all over.
Yeah.
But still, I mean, there's no way he should have dropped that far, but that was just because he returned to college. And I think we as folks in the media, we tend to do this as well. Like, we tend to crap on players who return to school because then suddenly we poke holes in their games.
Mm-hmm.
And that's unfair.
Yeah.
We should instead focus more on the player's development from year one or year two. Hang on a second. I'm just going to find Miles Bridges' profile real quick. I have it here. For example, Miles Bridges last year shot 68.5% from the free throw line. This year, that's 88%. So that's a 20 percentage point increase. But nobody really looks at that. They look at the raw stats. Oh, he's down in his rebounding. He's still at 16.9 points just this last year. Whereas he's down in shot blocking. He's a little bit down in threes. Oh, he's regressed.
Mm-hmm.
He statistically, yeah, but his influence and the way that Michigan State uses him, no. Like, it's clear that he is a developed player, but no. I mean, you just have to look for the small things where he did take huge leaps. I mean, if a guy comes into the league right now having shot 88% from the line, you look at him as more potential of a shooter, agreed?
Yeah. I'm just sad Jahlil Okafor didn't come back to school so they could have poked holes in his game.
That's fair.
Yeah. All right, Moit, let's pivot and talk about the Los Angeles Lakers, who since early January have gone 17-8. And they it should have been 18-7 had they held off Portland on Monday night, but Damian Lillard heard the phone call. It was Lillard time, and he single-handedly destroyed the Lakers in the last 6 minutes of that game. But even without that win, and they were playing without Brandon Ingram, who has a strained groin, I believe, and Josh Hart, who injured his hand, they still gave the Blazers, who are currently the number three seed in the West, they gave them a hell of a struggle. Yeah, so, I want to first play devil's advocate about this Lakers hot streak, because I do want to point out that a good number of these wins have come against truly terrible teams. So, of the 17, we have Atlanta, Sacramento, Dallas, the Knicks, the Bulls, Brooklyn, Phoenix, Dallas, Sacramento, Atlanta. That's 10 of the 17 right away that are just against even lower bottom feeders. They beat OKC twice, sans Andre Roberson. They've beat the Spurs twice, one of which came without Kawhi Leonard. So, you know, there might be some paper tiger in all of this. But at the same time, I mean, for a team that was 11-27 when they started this hot streak, they're now talking about, like, hey, you know, we could reach 500 by the end of the year. Yeah. Do you think that matters heading into this offseason, where they have made no secret about their plans to try to get a Paul George, a LeBron James, a DeMarcus Cousins, or two of them?
Well, it's funny because I recorded a very long Lakers podcast in Danish last night, and my co-host and I, we were pretty much in a full agreement they shouldn't go after these guys, because it seems like a better bet would just to keep the young core intact and see if they could add young pieces on the cheap. But if the goal for the Lakers is LeBron James or a Paul George or whatever, then obviously, yeah, that carries tremendous weight if you can finish the year strong and have a decent record. Thing is, though, where do you go from there? Like, even if you get a LeBron, and I mean, he's 33, and there are no real top dog on this team who can play alongside him. Like, what do you do here? Mm-hmm. The whole plan is just so weird to me. I'm not a fan of it. I mean, we were throwing like ideas up against the wall last night, and one that I got, I've been thinking about it all day because I think that could be interesting. You know, the Lakers should look at teams who made huge mistakes and try to capitalize off of that. For example, Orlando did not pick up the fourth year option on Mario Hezonja, and you can throw Hezonja into that system right now or this summer, and he would be a good fit with them. Because he is athletic, he can shoot, he can play off ball, on ball. That would just create a whole new dynamic for them and give them some depth while still maintaining their youth process. So, yeah, I mean, to answer your question, yes, it would help them. It definitely would help them going into the offseason if they finished on a high note. But I don't think the goal should be to, you know, make themselves more attractive to veteran free agents.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think this team finishing 500 or close to 500, I don't know that that sends the message to LeBron James that, like, come join us and we'll immediately beat the Rockets and the Warriors. You know, I think he realizes, even if you add Paul George and LeBron James, I still don't know that this Lakers team beats those two teams, right? Just because they are so good. And the Lakers would have to give up everyone. They would only have, like, Brandon Ingram, Lonzo Ball, Kyle Kuzma, and Josh Hart left, basically. Like, they'd have to give up Julius Randle, who has been playing phenomenally the last couple months. That hurts. I mean, that, you know, the lack of depth would come back to haunt them, even if you land these two superstars. That said, you know, I could see this becoming... Like, LeBron, I think, is his own... he's on his own tier of, you know, he's going to consider a bunch of different teams, a bunch of different situations. It wouldn't surprise me if he wants to stay in the East just to avoid the... You know, he's thinking about rings. He's toward the end of his career. He's like, I need to catch up with Michael Jordan. I don't want to play the Warriors and the Rockets before I even get to the finals. Paul George, though, I could see this actually, you know, coloring his thinking, especially... given how the Thunder have struggled of late without Roberson. You know, Carmelo Anthony has a $27.9 million player option for next season. If he doesn't pick up that player option, he should fire his agent immediately.
Oh yeah. No, that paperwork should already be filed and just ready. I mean, right.
So, like, this Thunder team is locked into what they have. And they're going to be paying the luxury tax next year if they re-sign Paul George.
Right.
So, like, you know, does he like playing with Russell Westbrook and Steven Adams? Maybe, but these struggles combined with the Lakers suddenly showing a pulse, you know, that it wouldn't surprise me if the two teams continue on their current trajectories. OKC down, Lakers up. If that helps swing him to the Lakers, which is not... This isn't exact, like, it's not a hot take. He's been openly flirting with them for over a year now. I mean, it sounds like the OKC had to do everything in its power to prevent him from going to the Lakers. And I don't know you know, kudos to Sam Presti for trying, but I don't think it's taken off the way he expected it to. I mean, if the Thunder miss the playoffs, he's gone, I think.
And oh yeah.
You know, they're very firmly, they're in that mix right now. I mean, we're recording this on Tuesday, March 6th. Right now, there are four games separating the Blazers, who are the third seed, and the Jazz, who are the 10th seed. So it is too early to be saying any team is going to miss the playoffs. We just don't know. Mm. But the Thunder is currently 7th. They're only a game and a half up on the Clippers, who are 9th. I don't know. I mean, it's certainly interesting to see the Lakers playing this well. And, I think, you know, Lakers' exceptionalism is very much a thing where they expect to sign every free agent because they're the Lakers. But yeah. I think if they continue along this path for the rest of the season, I don't think it's exceptionalism anymore. I just think a free agent sees, hey, this team has $60 million in cap space. Ingram's playing well. Lonzo's playing well. If they don't, you know, if they don't get this double max, the double max that they wanted to do, let's bring in Paul George for $30 million. Let's re-sign Julius Randle for $15 million. Let's see who, you know, can we retain Brooke Lopez for the mid-level exception? Like, well, they won't have the mid-level exception, but can we retain, you know, him for $8 or $9 million? Like, can we build out a decent team and continue this upward trajectory, keep our cap space for 2019, and then hey Kawhi, hey Klay Thompson, come join Paul George and Lonzo and Brandon Ingram in 2019.
Paul George and Brandon Ingram, that's three small forwards right there. That would be interesting.
Yeah. Well, Paul George could play, I mean, Paul George, all three of those guys could play the four.
Yeah, that's true. All right, so I think what your point here is, to your point, there's a difference in the Lakers going out and getting Paul George or LeBron James from an age perspective. Because Paul is going to be 28 when that contract theoretically would be signed. Yep. That's still in a similar vein as to the players that they have now, sort of. Kyle Kuzma is 22, Julius Randle 23. You know, it's not that big of a step. Whereas with LeBron, you would have a 10-year difference.
Yeah.
So the window would be smaller.
Yeah.
Or at least, a little bit more limited. So I would be more inclined to go off of Paul George than LeBron. And also because they hope, and they better be right, that Lonzo is going to turn into a star, or at least in a fringe all-star at the worst. Mm-hmm. But that, again, we've talked about this on the Philly episode with LeBron, you know, the rumors going on there. When LeBron goes somewhere, you know, whoever's the primary ball handler better get settled in for not being that.
Mm-hmm.
And Lonzo would get the ball taken out of his hands a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And as we've seen so far, offensively speaking, he's not really been that strong. He's a way better defender than he is an offensive player at this point in of his career. So adding LeBron to that mix and telling Lonzo, hey, go stand in the corner, that's not something that bodes well for his development either.
Right.
So I would be more inclined to go with Paul George because George is the off-ball player. Yeah. He's the guy who can spot off, run around screens, he can do all those things while still being able to handle the ball if necessary, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, to Lonzo's credit, he's been shooting better of late over his last five. He's shooting almost 59% from three-point range. Granted, that is an enormously small sample size, so I don't think you're making, hopefully, the Lakers aren't making a free agent decision based off of five games, but I agree more. Like, signing LeBron is a win-now move. I don't know that the Lakers, again, even if they sign Paul George and LeBron James, I don't know if they would be ready to truly challenge the Warriors, the Rockets, the Spurs once Kawhi is healthy, the Timberwolves when Jimmy Butler is healthy. Like, they'd be in that, I mean, the Warriors and the Rockets are in their own tier. They'd be in that next tier, but I don't know if they would get past either the Warriors or the Rockets. So I'm with you. I think the Paul George thing, like, by all means, go for it. Because, you know, yeah, he's in his prime. He's not going to want to join a team that's like 3 years away from competing for a playoff spot. But you add Paul George to this Lakers team and bring back Randall, they're going to be in the playoff hunt next year.
Yeah. They're going to be in the playoffs.
Yeah. I mean, the West is just such a bloodbath every year that it's hard to like say definitively yes, because I don't know who among the Clippers might fall just because the smoke and mirrors from, you know, however they're piecing this together might fall apart, but the other nine teams are going to be right back in the mix next year, presumably. I guess the Thunder could fall out if Paul
George leaves. They would definitely. That's what I'm thinking. And plus, I think Julius Randle is one of the most underrated players we have in the Western Conference right now.
Yeah, he's been playing incredibly.
He is incredible. That's the thing. I mean, when we went into this season, I mean, we were a lot of people going, Julius Randle is going to be the best player on the Lakers this year.
Mm-hmm.
And that was accurate. But the thing is, you know, the average Laker fan was sort of seduced by this LeBron talk, and that was kind of unfair to Randle, because then he became the sacrificial lamb.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone was just like, oh, okay, so you know what, I'm already disengaging from you.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that was fair to him. He's been playing so well. I've actually reached that stage where I'm looking at him and going, I don't know if the Lakers can afford to lose him.
Oh, yeah.
Regardless of who they sign.
Yeah, right. I mean, it feels like it always sounds dumb to say, like, a team would be better off not signing LeBron James, but
right,
given where they are in their rebuild trajectory or rebuild curve, I should say. Mm. Yeah, I mean, over his last 22 games, Randle's averaged 19 points, almost 9 rebounds, 3 assists, almost, you know, 58% shooting. Like, that's a player, like, he's going to get paid this summer. Like, he is one of the rare restricted free agents who is going to break the bank.
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, he's got a true shooting percentage of over 60. And the first year he was back after the injury, it was the knock on him was his lack of efficiency. Like, mm-hmm. he didn't take good shots, and a lot of people wrote articles, you know, about him potentially not being able to recover that ability. Mm-hmm. And to be one of the, he was like inclined to be one of those low efficiency scorers for the rest of his career. Well, hello.
Yeah.
That's not the case. And he's getting to the free throw line a lot more, and he's just being more selective with his shots, and it's working. He's playing tremendously in the fast break when it comes to like diming and handling the basketball for a 6'9 big. He's playing a lot of center now as well, and he's holding his own. And what is he right now? 23.
Mm-hmm.
23.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing. Like, he's going to get better as well.
Right.
For at least another 3 years. Like, this is not the mountaintop for him by any stretch of the imagination.
No, definitely. Like, his PER, true shooting percentage, and free throw rate have increased substantially every year over the last 3 years. Like, it feels weird to say it, but like, he has all-star potential, I think, if he hits the ceiling.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's going to be, I mean, I still don't take the Lakers seriously as a threat to sign both LeBron and Paul George. I could very well be wrong, and I will take that egg on my face if that's how it happens, but I do consider them a very real threat to sign Paul George. At this point, if I had to bet, I would say it's more likely that they sign Paul George than it is that he comes back to OKC.
I could go along with that one. I still think, though, having said all that, I would still prefer the route that I spoke about initially. You know, making teams pay for bad decisions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And also, this would be a little bit fun, because the Lakers were in that situation where they gave up D'Angelo Russell to give up Mozgov so they could clear cap space. Always, mm-hmm. I was not a fan of that deal.
Yeah.
But now they're in a place where they have so much cap space going, they could actually turn around and do the same thing with different teams.
That's true.
But they won't, because they sold the D'Angelo Russell trade on, hey, cap space.
Yeah. Well,
which is unfortunate, I think.
I mean, you know, again, to go back, they signed Paul George. They can sign Julius Randle. They have $15 million left. The Sixers are going to sign LeBron James. They need to jump Jared Bayless's contract. Call up the Lakers. Say, all right, you know, you'll take first round pick. Yeah, Jared Bayless, you can have one of our two first round picks this year. You can have Rashawn Holmes. You can have Luau Okafor. You can have Furkan Korkmaz.
Yeah. No, they could really make a killing if they did that.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I agree. If they use their cap space to extort another team, that would be a very smart. I mean, the one thing they should not do this summer is sign mediocre players to long term deals. Hopefully, they learned their lesson with Mozgov and Luol Deng 2 years ago. I think they're smart enough to see Luol Deng rotting on their bench for $18 million a year and know, you know, all right, if we have to bring Isaiah Thomas back, we sure as shit aren't giving him more than a 1 year deal.
Yep.
But it's going to be, they're going to be a fascinating team over the next couple months. All right, Mort, let's pivot now to Kevin Love and DeMar DeRozan, both of whom have released. Have given comments in DeRozan's case, and then Kevin Love released an article on the Players Tribune today, which is Tuesday, about his, I don't want to say struggles, but I guess he had a panic attack for the first time in November, and then, you know, recently he left that game against the Thunder with a quote-unquote illness, came under fire for it, has been famously discussed with Isaiah Thomas and Dwayne Wade, among others. ESPN's David McMenamin is now reporting that he did, in fact, suffer another panic attack during that loss to the Thunder, had to leave the game, had to leave the arena, I believe, after only a couple minutes. So, yeah. And then DeMar DeRozan, this was probably 2 weeks ago, or I guess during the All-Star weekend, he tweeted, quote, "This depression get the best of me." And then it kind of expanded on that in a interview with ESPN. He also spoke with Doug Smith of the Star in Toronto about it. I mean, on my end, I think it's so brave that those guys are like opening up about this. Just, you know, given the whole stigma around mental illness in this country. Especially no thanks to our president as of late. And Kevin Love in his essay was kind of talking about, you know, as a boy and as an athlete from a young age, you're taught to be tough and, you know, having something wrong with your mind isn't manly, so you can't discuss it. And I think it's awesome that those guys are breaking that stigma and are saying, look, there's, you know, everyone's got their own shit going on. There's nothing wrong. The worst thing you could do is bottle it up and not talk about it, because then it comes out in weird and bad ways and like self-destructive ways. So I hope that having these guys, you know, come out and give these kinds of stories and examples sets an example for people dealing with this kind of thing and that aren't, you know, that don't have someone to talk with it about.
I agree. Yeah, you know, I mean, I have a person in my life who's had it real rough with depressions for many, many, many years. Was able to talk about it, seek professional help and guidance, and was very communicative about it over the years, which helped. And that's definitely the way forward, because I've also experienced in my own network people who suddenly did weird things because they bottled it up. Mm-hmm. And I think it's more of, I mean, you touched on it, Kevin touched on it, in regards to being a man comes with certain expectations. And that, unfortunately, is a stigma that is... accurate, because we are being taught that men are, you know, the hunters and you know, we have to be strong for everyone, we have to be that rock all the time. And I think in always trying to be that rock, you sort of forget your own place. You sort of forget to check in on yourself and go, oh, hey, how are you doing today?
Right.
You know, I mean, hey, I've suffered from emotional stress, for example. I mean, you know, you know this situation. I think I can talk about this. You know, I was an editor-in-chief on a Canadian basketball site where you worked as well, called Hoop 365.
Yep.
And Mark Deeks was there as well, and Seth Partnow, and it was like the roster of guys there was incredible.
Yeah.
But the ownership was... No, I'm going to say it straight up. The ownership was batshit crazy.
Yeah.
Completely batshit crazy.
Yeah.
They were malicious and vicious, and they changed the direction of the site basically weekly. And as the editor-in-chief, I had to spend more time discussing with the owner in terms of what the direction had to be for the site than to actually edit pieces coming in from you guys. I remember... one time I had just received an article, a great article actually, from Seth Partnow, and I was about to edit it when the owner contacted me about an idea he had, which was just horrible and also illegal, because he wanted to basically rip video content from the NBA illegally and play it on their own player. And I was like, no, you can't do that. I don't want to be associated with that. No one wants to be associated with that. We'll all walk if that happens. And I spent I think almost 2 days in a very, very serious discussion with him about this, to the point where Seth, and bless his patience for waiting that long, because it was a time pressing post he had made, wrote me and said, hey, is that article ever going to come up? Which was very fair.
Sure.
But I mean, and I totally get why he was pushing for that article to come out. But I was in survival mode at that point in time, because that boss was going to do something that would affect the reputation of all of us. And that was just a very difficult position, because he constantly put me and Mark in these situations where we had to leave our regular work and kind of talk him down from pure insanity ideas. And that it stressed me the hell out. I mean, it was really, really difficult to just wake up in the morning and know every day that, you know, I'm potentially in a fight here, because this guy is going to come up to me with some crazy ass idea, and I'm going to have to spend the next 10, 12 hours of the day just talking to him, communicating with him, and trying to, you know, make him understand this is a bad idea for whatever reason. And when you can't do your work and you can't even allow yourself the time to look in the mirror and go, how are you doing today? You're going to be messed up. And when I resigned that position, Mark and I resigned within 15 minutes of each other, actually. We were very, yeah, sure, we lost some financial aspects, which were pretty important, especially for Mark, but we gained a whole lot. I mean, it was the monkey coming off our backs. It was just the ability to just knowing the following day that we did not have to deal with that person, that we did not have any responsibility in whatever went down. It was very difficult. And because I spoke about it to my wife, then girlfriend, almost every day, every hour, I mean, I was able to get feedback. I was able to get this thing lifted off of me, so I didn't go completely insane. I mean, I had nights where I was sitting, because I was working U.S. times, because, you know, Canada and all that. And there were evenings where I was just sitting at the computer, and I was messaging with him on Skype, and I could not get through to this bastard. And I was just sitting there, and I found myself just crying and crying and crying and crying, because it was so frustrating that some of the things that he wanted to steal code from people as well. It was weird. Oh my God. Weird. Everything was weird. And I mean, at the end, you couldn't take it anymore. You just couldn't take it anymore. But being able to talk about it was huge. And I advise everyone, right, everyone who's got it rough with family or work or friends or relationships, like romantic relationship, whatever. Talk. I mean, in this day and age as well, everyone has moved on. This is not the 1940s or 50s anymore.
Yeah.
Like if to the people out there listening, like if you are, you know, maybe homosexual and you feel that you can't tell that to people, I would strongly advise you to revisit that position and make you, to suggest to you to tell them anyway, because mm-hmm. people are definitely way more accepting of a hell of a lot of things today than they were, you know, 40, 60, or maybe even 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It's a different world. And I would just advise everyone to, who feels bad or feels out of place, whatever, just talk.
Yeah. Well, more, that's the clearest sign yet that you don't live in the South, because down here, we're still a little backwards at times. But no,
even with homosexuality in 2018. Oh my God.
Yeah. Well, not in Nashville. Nashville is a liberal city, but outside, absolutely. 150%, yes.
I mean, I know they like their guns, and I know they like their people white, but I thought that...
Oh, no.
Okay. Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, they gotta be white.
I keep having, apparently, too high an opinion of the United States,
You sure do.
That's on me. My apologies.
I'm gonna bring it down more, don't worry, over the coming weeks. But yeah, I mean, to your point, and both Kevin and DeMar said this too, and Kevin wrote, I'm going to quote it exactly. He said, everyone is going through something that we can't see. And DeMar mm-hmm. said, you never know what that person is going through. And it's true. I mean, everyone's got shit going on in their lives. And I think part of it is we live in this like Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat culture where we personally curate the best parts of our lives. And show them and show, like, look at how happy I am. I'm having so much fun. I'm doing all this cool shit. But then, like, in the day-to-day where you're feeling stressed or you're feeling down, you're not going to post a picture of yourself, like, kind of just feeling like shit. You're just, you know, you're going to pretend like everything's okay and just not post that day or move on or post a picture of your dog with a muddy nose or something. So, yeah, like, you and I have known each other for years now. Like, we got to know each other more as that whole site started to crash and we became friends, like, you know, during that whole nonsense. But, you know, throughout the last couple of years, like, we've each had our own stuff going on outside of this podcast. We use this podcast as a refuge, frankly, from some of the real life stuff that we've got going on. So, you know,
absolutely,
I'm sure that's true for not only everyone in basketball Twitter, it's true for everyone. And I think, you know, having these guys come out and talk about it is huge. Mm-hmm. And I hope that we can all learn from that. And, you know, before the next time you're about to, like, jump down someone's throat on Twitter because they tweeted something stupid or it's tweeted something, hell, that you just don't agree with, like, just take a second and realize, like, maybe, you know, maybe there's a reason they posted that outside of they just want to be a troll. Like, Skip Bayless, flame the hell away, you know, who cares? Because that's just how he makes a living. But, you know, I just think the world in general could use a lot more decency these days. And hopefully we start pivoting back toward that in the coming months and years. But, yeah, like, just empathizing with people and realizing, like, you just don't know what someone else is going through. Like, you know, you feel like you know people on Twitter because you see their tweets every day and you like tweet back and forth with them, but you don't know until they either come out publicly and say it or you have a side conversation with them. But, you know, just because you see Matt Moore's tweets every day doesn't mean you know, like, all the stress he's going through on a day-to-day life. Or, you know, it goes for anyone. Like, any major figure on basketball Twitter. So I think it's, I wanted to shout out both Kevin and DeMar for shining a spotlight on this and, you know, having the courage to Kevin said, like, it takes a lot. It goes against your instincts as an athlete, you know, based on gender constructs as a man, you're like not supposed to talk about this stuff, but
right.
you know, I think you're right, Mort. The best, like, the worst thing you could do is not talk about it. The best thing you can do is be open and honest with people and say, hey, I've got this shit going on. Like, someone help me talk it out.
I would not. I mean, my wife and I have been together since we were 18 years old. Mm-hmm. We're turning 32 this year. We would not have been together for this long had I not been the exact opposite of my parents in terms of talking about my emotions, because mm-hmm. I was used to parents who were slightly closed off and where, you know, oh, things would work itself out sort of a way, you know. And I hated that. As a kid, I didn't understand because I always asked a lot of questions. And then I realized, okay, you have answers. You just don't want to talk to me about it because, oh, it might be emotional. And I just vowed at a very early age, I should communicate. Mm-hmm. And I mean, Jesus, the kind of type of relationship that I have with my wife right now, because we are able to communicate about everything. Like, it doesn't mm-hmm. even matter how small it is. It's so wonderful. And yeah. I think a lot of men fear, you know, communication with their girlfriends or wives because they are under the assumption that, you know, the woman will look at that man and go, oh, you're weak because you're talking about your feelings. No, she will look at you in the exact opposite view, mm-hmm. honestly. That's a sign of strength. And I just want to close this segment off by saying one thing, and that's for everyone listening out there who, you know, are rolling their eyes at the conversation we're having right now. You don't get it then.
Yeah.
You don't get it. And if you're the type of person who is going to go, oh, Kevin Love said that, well, he's soft as a result.
Or right.
DeMar DeRozan said, well, he's soft. Go fuck yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Like, you're part of the problem, not part of the yeah. solution. Like,
and when yeah. I say that, I don't try to be malicious. I'm basically telling you, think in different ways than you do right now because you're in the wrong.
Right. Yeah. I think I couldn't agree more. All right, Mort, let's finish things off with our crush of the week. And these are
back to basketball. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm going to cheat on mine. I'm going to let you go first.
Yeah. Well, you know what? Because you're cheating, that means you haven't realized how good my guy is for this week. And I'm going to nail you right now with it. Bojan Bogdanovic from the Indiana Pacers, averaging 21.6 points a game over the last five, shooting 57.7% from downtown, 88.5% from the free throw line, 56.5% overall. He's not rebounding worth a damn despite being 6'8", but that's just who he is, so that's fine. But this guy is scoring at will, draining three triples at night and taking 5.2 free throws. Bogdanovic for a while now has been a monster and he needs to be recognized.
I like it. I you know what, just because of that, I'm gonna throw Alan Crabb back in your face.
Nice.
Yeah, because like Bogdanovic, but he had a terrible game against the Clippers on I believe it was Sunday. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But prior to that, over his previous eight games, 20.8 points on 45.5% shooting 40.5% from three on 10.5 attempts per game. He was averaging 4.3 triples, 4.3 rebounds, 1.3 assists, 1.0 steals in 34 minutes. Mort, I think I'm going to win our bet on the Nets not making the playoffs and hell, not even cracking 30 wins, even though I feel dirty about it.
But, injuries, yeah. Injuries. That's all I'm saying. Had Jeremy Lin been healthy, that they would have been like the eighth seed. I'm just gonna, I'm gonna die on this hill because I refuse to acknowledge.
You most certainly will, as they are 13.5 games back of the eighth seed right now.
All right, I lost this one, but Donovan Mitchell, he's my bet now. Yep. Now that's I have a chance of redemption here.
He's been, yeah, no, you already redeemed yourself. He was your bet prior to the draft, and you won that one resoundingly.
Yeah, but like if he wins Rookie of the Year, though.
Oh, yeah.
That would be the cherry on top. I need that to happen.
We're saving that war for another episode about a month down the road. But I also do want to shout out the guys from the Rights to Ricky Sanchez podcast who arranged probably one of the most ridiculous trips in NBA history. They got about 400 people to fly into Chicago, spend the weekend in Chicago, take a bus up to Milwaukee, go to the Sixers-Bucks game on Sunday, in part because Embiid famously called Milwaukee a shithole on Instagram last year, which was spectacular, but also because Malcolm Brogdon wrongly stole the Rookie of the Year from both Embiid and Saric last year. So,
oh, the pettiness is real.
It's amazing. Yeah, you could hear them, like, watching that game on Sunday. You could hear the trust the process chants from the upper deck, which was spectacular. Less great was the Sixers getting 2 15-point leads and then blowing both and losing that game. And the Milwaukee fans were apparently very happy to usher the Philly fans out that night. But shouts to the rights to Ricky Sanchez, guys. You've actually created a cult, and it's hilarious. And when the Sixers win a title in 3 years, I expect you guys to start creating a Sam Hinkie statue the next day.
There you go.
All right. So on that note, thank you to everyone for tuning in today. Please check us out on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bio, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes. So please subscribe, download, leave some 5-star reviews. We'd love any feedback. And we're being hosted this year on FanRag Sports. So check them out on Twitter at FanRag Sports and for their NBA content at FRS Hoops with a Z. I'm Brian Toporek. Until next time, I was joined by Morten Jensen. Have a good one, Mort.
You too, Brian. Take care.